Australia's magazine market finds itself in a state of evolution this year as once influential titles fade away and a new crop of publishing talent takes hold. But whether it's a fearless new launch disrupting the establishment or a prestigious original, the rules are certainly being rewritten. That's today on The Stack. On today's programme, a familiar face to Australians, Lisa Wilkinson, publisher and co-host of The Today Show, gives her insights into the state of Australia's magazine playing field.
You know, I really admire editors like Anna Wintour who really have still a very strong sense of how important the editorial is, because that's what differentiates us from a straight ad.
Plus, a progressive young title forging its own path to the newsstand. We'll hear from Girls Like Us magazine.
I think we represent a different way of living, and our aim would be, you know, like sort of moving away from a patriarchic society and the male ego.
All that plus a leaf through some of our favourite titles coming up today on The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis show. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. We'll be talking to Jeremy Leslie a little later, going through some standout titles to look out for this week. But first, many Australians will know the work of Lisa Wilkinson quite well. At the age of just 21, she became the youngest ever editor of youth title Dolly. And 4 years after that, she was appointed editor of the trailblazing women's magazine Clio. Today she's bidding Australians good morning as co-host of the Today Show on the Nine Network. Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé spoke to Lisa in Sydney.
There's many things I want to cover within the Australian media landscape, but maybe we should just go for a little bit of a quick jaunt down memory lane. If you sort of look from your sofa position in studio at the state of Australian media, do you feel it's a more innovative environment where you're sitting today, or has it become slightly more homogenized because, of course, we've seen, you know, international takeovers, we've seen so many mergers within the Australian landscape, or has that actually forced maybe even more unique voices within Australia?
Well, you're talking to someone who edited a magazine in Australia called Clio that at the time I was editing it, we were number one women's lifestyle magazine per capita in the world. And last Friday, I went to its closing. And this was a magazine that was up against Cosmopolitan here in Australia and always whipped its backside. What we're finding here in Australia, particularly when it comes to magazines, that they are closing at a rate of knots. And I think that was a combination of, or has been, a case of bad management mixed in with an absolute resolute denial that this thing called the internet was going to have a major effect on magazines. So the landscape from that point of view has changed enormously. We have a really diverse range of media here, a lot of homegrown product that that Australia's really embraced. So that magazine environment really spawned a lot of the people who are making huge strides in Australian media.
I think it was interesting how you point out bad management, because that's tends to be one of the equations, or it's, you know, one of the things that's rarely spoken about. Everyone often just points to the internet, saying, you know, we can only really put digital on trial for really causing all of the damage to print. But I think it's a really interesting point, because if I look back at, you know, various boards that I've worked with over the years as well, when I was in more of a corporate world, and I think, you know, just looking, you know, across London, New York, elsewhere, I mean, you see so many missteps which are happening. At one point, yes, as you said, the denial of this thing called digital was coming. So, you know, what form and shape should magazines have been taking, should they be taking today? So do you think we've also been almost a little bit too lost? We just, you know, we want to blame all of the print problems solely on digital when, you know, oftentimes it was a lack of innovation around the boardroom table or on the editorial floor, and people just not willing to actually push print in a direction that it needs to go in, which it needs to be more tactile. It needs to feel very different than a magazine where they cut the hell out of it. So, you know, it becomes just, you know, a flimsy brochure. Why would I buy it at the end of the day?
Sure. Couple of things coming from that question. In the late 90s, when it was clear to me and to some others, but not a lot of people in management, unfortunately, at ACP, which was the magazine company that Kerry Packer owned, the biggest media baron outside of Rupert Murdoch Australia has ever seen, and he owned the biggest magazine business in the country. But the management there really believed that this internet thing was just a passing fad. And I suppose it's largely because magazines were a license to print money at that time. The magazine that I was editing, Clio, was making $25 million a year. You know, the rivers of gold were flowing, and it was the same in newspapers. Classifieds in a newspaper like the Sydney Morning Herald. On a Saturday, the papers were so thick that it was like a brick that landed at the gate. And everybody used to love diving into the pages of that brick. And, you know, what wasn't recognised that was that what the internet wanted more than anything was content. And the opportunities that were available were if you had a brand that was already known, your audience, when they went to the internet, would find a logo that they knew, a product that they knew, a brand that they were comfortable with and trusted. That's a very easy transition. But there was a belief that, you know, we've got a $5.95 cover price, we're getting huge dollars from our advertisers, we don't want the eyes heading elsewhere, we want them staying right here on the printed page, and that $5.95 coming in from every single copy we can possibly sell. That's where things started going wrong. But the interesting thing is, and I am a magazine girl, so maybe I'm biased, I still love buying magazines. But what's happening now is I don't think we'll see many new magazines opening up. But you look at a business model like netaporter.com. Of course, Natalie Massenet came from Tatler magazine. And she basically cut out the middleman. You know, so many fashion magazines are all about selling clothes, and she went straight to the clothes-selling model. But what she discovered is to keep growing that brand and to deliver the intimacy that magazines are so good at doing and that brand loyalty, she started Porter Magazine. So I think that's the business model for magazines now. You start something online, and to keep that brand loyalty and the brand involvement and the intimacy and the tactile nature that magazines offers, that's how you get the magazine side of things going, to just keep that regular contact.
You came from an editorial world, and I think it's interesting how you bring up Porter. Is there a danger, though? Because I'm sure in your days at Dolly, now maybe, okay, let's say the advertising stakes with major brands were not the same at Dolly as they would have been if you would have been at Vogue or elsewhere. But certainly, you know, at Clio, you know, big relationships with all of the FMCG groups, you know, and also, you know, fashion as well. I imagine you grew up in an era, same time as I did, where there was a pretty clear divide between church and state. Of course, advertisers need to be serviced within a magazine world, absolutely no question about that. But are you a little bit worried about the blurring that we start to see? And I would say even a lot of it, the blurring partly fueled by Australia, because Aussies love to buy online. I mean, I was just in Milan or New York, and it's amazing talking to all of the big international groups. They say they wish every country was like Australia, because you're such early adopters. And I would say what fortunes Net-a-Porter does have been largely fueled by Australia in many ways. And now, of course, we see other groups, Condé Nast, Hearst, all trying to sort of move to a model that was set up by Natalie, but one which also starts to blur, very much the line between what is commercial, what is editorial. When is a great brand well and truly chosen by the editor just because it's fantastic and they're not spending one penny in the magazine, versus maybe a magazine or a brand being coerced by someone who's spending hundreds of thousands and they want their product to be pushed front and center. Is that a danger? And again, has the horse bolted? Are those days gone where we can see truly legitimate garments articles put in a magazine simply because the editor liked them?
I think the days are gone. You know, I really admire editors like Anna Wintour who really have still a very strong sense of how important the editorial is, because that's what differentiates us from a straight ad. Otherwise, you know, why bother with journalism at all? But in order to have that good journalism, you do need to be a viable product. You do need to keep advertisers happy. But, I mean, you may not know this, but the word advertorial was actually first coined in Australia. That's a sadness for us, but it was the way things move. But it is a case of give an inch and they'll take a mile. And the minute you open that gate, it's a finger in a dike that's not going to last terribly long.
That was Lisa Wilkinson speaking to Monocle's Tyler Brulé on the line in Sydney. Next on The Stack, we turn to an independent magazine pitched squarely at the politically savvy, primarily female reader. The publication was based mainly in the Netherlands, but is now experimenting with a truly international approach, producing its pages from multiple locations. Founded in 2005, Girls Like Us explores the legacies of leading feminists down the years, from art to writing, mixing politics with pleasure. The editor is Jessica Geisel. She explains how to tackle subjects with weight while remaining informal and how to make a magazine with a team spread all around the world. Monocle's contributor Alexandra Stenbock-Furmore spoke to her in Brussels.
I had some friends in Amsterdam and we were all part of one lifestyle magazine there. And they went on to make Butt magazine, which is quite a famous gay zine. Yeah, and then they asked me to make a female version of that. So there was like the very, very initial version of Girls Like Us was called Cut, was like the female counterpart of that Butt magazine. And then it evolved over the years into this. So it started more as a fanzine, and now it's like bigger and more colorful. I think we represent a different way of living, and our aim would be, and that's super trendy right now, you know, like sort of moving away from a patriarchic society and the male ego, but it's something we've been saying it for like 10 years since we first started. So what we do is we represent a lot of women that work in a more collaborative and collective way, mostly in the creative sector, like a lot of artists or small publishers. Also artists who have organic farms or, yeah, sort of try to find a new economic model in a way as well, and a way to have a more fulfilling life. And I think that's what we mean when we say we present an international group. I don't even know how we phrase it, but it's, I think it's important to show like different options, different ways of creating a life. And I think a life which is a bit away from only making money or only making career, or only having one option, and be more true to who you think you are, and not like this idea that other people have you should be. Or
And the word, the fact of being feminist in the 90s has been often considered as a bad word, but right now the word feminist is kind of coming back into force. Have you seen a difference in the way that the magazine is doing?
Yes. Yeah, because I think it's funny, since we've been around for 10 years, yeah, like at one point we opened up from saying, in the beginning we said we were like a lesbian or a queer magazine, or we say it's more feminist, because I felt there was a need to open it up to a bigger group of people. And indeed, because I think the word feminist is being embraced by a lot of younger people. We try to have like one voice, but at the same time we have different voices as well, because I think we really want to represent like different kinds of women and different kinds of femininity, sexuality, gender. Although I think we're quite recognizable, but we really try to keep it quite open in that way.
So what is your tone of voice that is recognizable then?
I think we're always very inviting. Like, you're welcome, come say hello. We're not very formal in that way. It's not like, dear reader. I think we really want people to come and collaborate and participate.
I just think it's interesting how wanting to blur, for example, the limits between the two genders is still often associated with feminism, but the word feminism itself is like associated to women. So
yeah,
it's
yeah,
kind
yeah,
of
yeah.
in contradiction with the fact of wanting to blur the...
I think for us, the feminist is, it's really more like how we position ourselves as a magazine, and what I said, like our values or references or way of behavior or all these kind of things. But then there's a lot of theory around it, and I think gender studies are more and more popular, and it's good, it's there, but we try to not to be too theoretic. I think we really try to practice the theory, or put the theory into practice, by more showing how it can be than actually talk about it or analyze it or trying to define it.
And the theme of the last edition is the bodies, right?
Yeah.
How do you talk about bodies and how do you show bodies without being gendered?
I think we use the word body in a way to also like wink to all the theory there is around bodies, because you have, of course, a body can be many different things, like literal body, but it can also be like more abstract as a body of resistance or a body for revolution. So I think in this issue, we really try to have, not all because that's impossible, but we have like different definitions of the word body and use it in a playful way. So we have artists working with their body. We had interviews with a lot of healers who like sort of do natural ways to make your body better, dancing, bodily activities, and what I said also, like bodies as tools for evolution or for change. So we have all these things in there. And how it's related to gender, well, I don't know. I think it's, for me, it's clear. I mean, no matter what gender you are, you have a body, you know.
What do you look forward to in the future with Girls Like Us? Do you, when you say looking forward to a post-gender?
A post-gender feminist utopian, I think we're going to explore also to see if we can do more in the physical, or how do you call it, like next to the magazine, have more like real places or spaces where people can meet and interact. So invite more of the people that we feature in the magazine to do things and really create a sort of context where we can explore and experiment a bit with the things we talk about in the magazine.
Jessica Geisel there, editor of Girls Like Us magazine, in conversation with Alexandra Stenbock-Furmore. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and our guest today is a regular voice on this programme. It's Jeremy Leslie from Mad Culture. Jeremy, great to have you with us, as always.
Good to be back.
How is Planet Mad Culture? What's going on?
Planet Mad Culture is busier than ever. We opened our shop back in December, so that's taking up a lot of time and effort, but it is the realisation of a dream, and it's the dream is being lived.
Exactly. How's that treating? Because we obviously we're a bit obsessed with the idea of the bricks and mortar manifestation of some of our favourite magazines, some of our favourite ideas. Mm-hmm. What's it been like? Has it lived up to? Is it a dream to do as much as it was a dream to do it in the first place? If you see what I mean.
It was bloody hard work getting it open, but then since then it has been developing very smoothly.
Yeah.
We're developing a good regular clientele. We're online as well, and we're selling a lot of things.
Great.
And it's very satisfying to see. It's almost, I wouldn't go as far as to say we could put anything on the shelves and it would sell, but
that's the real dream.
It's really interesting to see the breadth of stuff that people will buy. You know, we've got 270 different titles, and just about every single one of them we've had to restock. So
yeah, that's pretty good. And is it about, you know, do you sort of consider yourself now to be a retailer, or is it about being, dreaded word I know, but a sort of a curator of a magazine offer, or is it wrong to kind of make distinctions between those things, I guess, in a way?
I get asked this. In a way, it's just a natural kind of progression from making magazines to writing about magazines to selling magazines. It's a fantastic insight. It ties together so many other things that we've been doing, so it just makes sense.
Yeah, and it's good fun as well, isn't it?
And it's great fun.
Do you think you're starting to think about stocking stuff that you wouldn't simply because there's a physical space, or is that slightly pretentious? Does that change anything for you?
I guess. Well, I mean, it's been interesting being surprised by some of the types of magazines that sell. Yeah. By which I mean, we are focused on the magazines that we cover online on the Journal, which tends to be the independent sector, but isn't exclusively that. But things like long form literature. Literary magazines, I thought, were rather a past form, but they're hugely popular. So we take more of them. It's a learning curve to figure out what people actually want, and you know, so it's fascinating from that point of view.
It is fascinating indeed. Well, we love a good bricks and mortar story, as you know, Jeremy. Right, it's The Stack. Let's delve into your stack of magazines. Some weeks, you know, I'll sort of compliment my guests and say, "Oh, yes, this is a very exciting selection," or "Oh, I'm really looking forward to this," and I'm only half telling the truth, but all of these I'm looking forward to talking about.
Excellent.
Let's start with what's on the top of your pile. Tell us what you've got there.
This is a magazine called, I think you pronounce it, Shukyu. It's a football magazine from Japan. I happen to love football and I happen to love magazines.
You and me both,
a
Jeremy.
A football magazine.
Exactly.
What could be better than that?
It doesn't get much better than this. Well, tell us, what's the kind of approach? Are there any, I don't know, can you compare and contrast with any
others? The trouble is that most football magazines that come to mind perhaps aren't that exciting. They tend to be about facts and figures and maybe more for teenagers than people of our delicate age.
Nicely put. I was just going to jump in there. So what's the strategy here then? Is it, because it, you know, I don't know to describe it, it doesn't necessarily, I mean, there's people playing football on the front, but it doesn't scream football mm-hmm. magazine, does it?
No, it doesn't. No, it's a really well put together, well designed, well made magazine, first and foremost. So I wrote about it on the journal this week, and I praised it for its size and its sort of just the physical magnification. It's a lovely flickable magazine, first and foremost. But it treats football just, you know, there's just a lovely kind of cultural approach to football. It's not too serious. There's a great story in there about a photo story, which is basically a taxonomy of the different positions that players get to when they're injury prone on the floor. And there's just a range of different positions, all of which, as a fan, you will recognise those positions. And it doesn't really comment on it or make a big point of it. It doesn't have to. It just makes the point that in football, this is something that happens in this part of the theatre, and it's the day-to-day of football. And
so that's nice.
It's a beautifully observed, simple thing that doesn't, is understated and tongue-in-cheek, but doesn't sort of go running at you saying this is funny.
The first issue was roots. That was a sort of broad sort of theme of it, I guess. Mm-hmm. This is the body issue. I can see that, because despite the fact that it is in Japanese, it says body issue on the front, so that's
it
not
does
escaping.
Which is a handy clue,
and I guess that's what it means. And it's going to take these broad things, but does that become kind of, it's not a kind of heavy thematic that runs through it, it's still done with a certain lines.
No, it just draws it together. I mean, like, as I say, the kind of body positions of injuries, you know, there's a interview with Japanese footballer Kagawa, and that's all about his health regime, and so it's a much more literal interpretation of the body and the modern kind of football athletic approach to football. And then there are things, there's a story about a football training centre which happened to be in the area of the earthquake in Japan, and about the problems around diet and what they've been doing there. So it's very generous in its interpretation of body, but it just gives it a kind of thread that holds it together. But it's just a beautifully put together magazine that sometimes you hear people say this, and maybe this is pushing it a little, but it's almost a sort of magazine about football that could appeal to people that don't think they like football.
Yeah, which is often held up as the... I don't know what that says about the beautiful game, that it needs to do that, but there we are. There are one or two other examples that have kind of gone down that territory. Things like Howler, or... You know, there are a few good efforts, brings that sort of... It is a uniquely, I don't know what, a Japanese sensibility. It's got the detail. It's got the... There's something just very considered about it.
Yeah, it's very, very considered, as I say, from a physical item point of view. Every element of production. The advantage over the issue two has over issue one is that there is a kind of a folded-in translation. So there is the English language version in the middle as well.
So that's going to go from strength to strength, presumably.
Yes, I hope so. We've got it in stock in the shop and it's selling well. So, we'll spread the word.
Excellent. We will do. Let's move on. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about Zeit magazine, mm-hmm. which is, again, is something that many guests on the stack like to talk about. Well, I suppose that's a question. Why do you think that is? It's obviously, you know, it's got great people who make it. They do incredible stuff. The covers are incredibly creative, etc., etc. But there's something, I don't know, there almost seems to be something more about Zeit magazine. It's just very, very good.
I just think there's a really delicate touch to everything that they do. Mm. They know exactly what they're about. They're Christoph Amend and Mirko Borsch and the art team, it's just very measured what they're doing, and they do, you know, it's a weekly magazine, and you know, we know what the weekly newspaper magazines are like in this country. They're a mixed bunch, very hard to really pick on one and say it's a brilliant magazine. Whereas Zeit magazine seems to be able to pull it off regularly, rather like the last magazine. Of course, it is in German, and unless you have German, you're not really going to be able to judge it. But there is they do produce the biannual English compilation, which gives you a clue. But I think just from their approach to content and the stories they tell, the way the double cover works is always delightful. But I think the recent issue they did, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, that I wanted to highlight today was the one celebrating the newspaper's 70th anniversary. The only hitch in the plan in terms of the Zeit magazine was that it was only created and launched 40 years ago, so it didn't exist 70 years ago. But this is a great example of how they get around that kind of thing, and they hit the point just so. They imagined what the magazine would have been, what that launch magazine would have been 70 years ago in 1946, and made that magazine.
Only they would even try to do that.
Yeah, but they execute it perfectly. You know, their cover staff for the issue is Marlene Dietrich, who, as it happened, had just arrived back from the States, having been in exile through the war, having escaped the Nazi regime. And there's stories like that, so kind of which were timely. Someone might think of that idea and they might do it, and they might not do it properly, they might not do it fully, or they might do it half, but they've done it from top to bottom. So the crossword is set in 1946. Yeah. There's a regular infographic that they do every issue, and this one tells the story of where people migrating back into the country, having, like Marlene Dietrich, left the country, where they went to live. So it's just timely. If you're going to do that, you know, you want to show you're enjoying it, and that enjoyment comes through even to a non-German reader.
It sizzles off the pages, Jeremy.
Absolutely, it jumps at you.
Let's move on. Let's talk about Pitchfork Review, which is your next selection.
Yeah, so Pitchfork is a huge music website. About a couple of years ago, they launched their Review, a printed magazine, which was an interesting development. Since then, of course, Condé Nast have bought the whole lot, part and parcel, so it's now a Condé Nast property.
That's always interesting, just to jump in there. Obviously it changes a lot of things, but I mean, as a reader, as a consumer of that magazine, I guess it makes you approach it in a slightly different way. But does it reshape everything?
Or? Well, it maybe makes you approach it slightly gingerly, wonder what's going to happen, whether the paper's suddenly going to become kind of tissue thin and whatever. But no, the magazine's still as lovely as ever. Not convinced by the front cover, but that's just one of those. They've had some such strong front covers, and this one is a recreation of a Prince LP sleeve in black and white. Not a great fan of that, but inside it's as varied and rich as ever.
And what about, because people, I guess, were familiar with longer form writing. We've already talked a little bit about that in your store. Still, there's still plenty of words on the page.
Oh, yes. This is very much a bit of the content's picked up from online, but extended. And then there's a real focus on long form writing, on kind of trawling through our musical shared culture. Yeah. So you get the fantastic mix of stories. There is a long profile of the Prince album, Dirty Mind. But then there's also a great set of pictures from Dave Swindells, who was shooting all the rave clubs in the 80s in the UK. And there's a fantastic just record of that era. It's not tied to anything in particular. It's just, let's have a look back at the 80s. It's fantastic.
Wonderful stuff.
I mean the 90s, of course.
Yeah. A lot of people lost a decade or two around there somewhere. Time is short today. So let's, without further ado, Jeremy, mention your last selection. I know we could talk about Pitchfork all day, but you've also got Editorial magazine. I don't know. We talk sometimes about eclectic approaches, stuff that maybe doesn't really necessarily hang together in the most sort of predictable way. What's the deal with Editorial?
Well, this is a kind of art and artist magazine published in the States. It's kind of the counterpoint to sort of every other magazine that we might have mentioned in the past. Yeah. It is completely over the top, flamboyant, messy, lots of kind of weird typographic effects and references. It's just a refreshing antidote to so much kind of white space and black and white typography. There's lots of kind of Victorian vignettes and drop cap letters and fanciness. And around that, there's really good written content, albeit kind of, you've just never sort of seen it visually presented like this. It's the antithesis of something like Zeit magazine, which is beautifully made.
And all the better for it?
Let's have it all, you know. it's a really exciting magazine. Visually, it's just completely OTT. There's another title called Buffalo Zine, which has been doing a similar thing. And I think sometimes I worry there's danger that all these magazines get cooler and cooler and whiter and more austere. And actually, sometimes you need something that's just bright and brash and just shouts at you. And that's doing a very good job.
Here's an easy question for you, Jeremy, to finish on. Describe the cover image of Editorial magazine in a word or two.
Well, we have a...
See, it's tricky, isn't it? I knew that was a tricky one.
A figure cooking in the kitchen, but she seems to have a duck's head. It's a Photoshop... I don't know
exactly
what it is.
No, that's it. That's the perfect thing.
It's not a magazine that gives you a clue about what it's about. No. And that's maybe something refreshing
And that's something to celebrate as well. That's Jeremy Lesney from Mag Culture, our good friend here on The Stack. Jeremy, thanks for coming to talk magazines with
us
as always.
Good to see you.
And that is indeed all we have time for on this week's programme. My thanks to our producers, Ben Ryland and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our editors, Wei Donglin and Claire Urban. Any comments or queries are welcome as ever. Drop us a note at info@monocle.com. And remember to join us at the same time next weekend. You can always listen again at monocle.com or via iTunes if you just can't wait that long. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. And until next time, it's goodbye.